friends, this is your co-host, Will Blue Otter. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Blue Otter, seventh great grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Osio, Didani Lasti, welcome to the official website village homepage of the Cherokee Nation of Mexico. The Cherokee Nation of Mexico is officially recognized by the Republic of Mexico, one of three countries, Canada, the United States, and Mexico, which make up all of North America. The Cherokee Nation of Mexico and the Spanish Dominion was first recognized in the 1700s, and was spiritually mandated in 1842 by one of the most influential of Native Americans, the great Cherokee intellect, educator, and freedom activist, Sequoia. It is the purpose of the Cherokee Nation of Mexico and Chief Charles Chaflohi Kingfisher Rogers, M.D., and all of its members to help bring all Cherokees together, as was prophesied by Sequoia on his deathbed. He said that, quote, "A Cherokee child would someday come and find my tomb, and then my spirit will return to my people," end quote. Thus reinforcing the most traditional values and treasures of honesty, brotherhood, and respect. It is only then that Cherokees will be able to act as skillful guides in the art of brotherhood and beneficial examples of service to humanity. In other words, Gadugi, unpaid community effort for community good. Sequoia felt that this was our destiny as Cherokees. He felt that just the opportunity to strive toward this goal was a gift provided by Neitlanahi, the provider. All Cherokees, all Native American tribes, and any man, woman, and child of any ethnic group is more than welcome to use our information in any self-enriching, educational, and non-commercial manner. We ask only that you come to us with the spirit of a good heart, which we promise to return in full measure. We, like yourselves, are a kind and gentle people. We want our friends to always feel better off for knowing us. But I must warn you, if you have a dark heart or are consumed with hatred, we and every Cherokee who came before us will see you before you get here. Hear me well. Stay away. We are Cherokee, the Yanianwiya. You will not like being near us or our website, much less our Cherokee ways of honesty, brotherhood, and spirit. May those afflicted with these problems overcome and be released from their bondage. For all others of good heart, we invite you to freely enter our website and do so through the smoke of the cedar prayer. We pray Uneklunahi, the provider of all things, continue to bless you and your family. May your family and ancestors be pleased with the progress of your life's journey toward goodness. And so again, I say, Ditani Lansti, welcome. Kalchor De Hiyaha. Come in. Before our historic recognition by the very progressive and courageous governor of Coahuila, Mexico, Mr. Enrique Martinez y Martinez, on August the 22nd of 2001, there had been four other successful Cherokee migrations to Mexico. Before 1720, 25% of the Cherokees speaking a fourth dialect of the language left for Mexico. The remaining Cherokees escorted them as far as the Mississippi. In 1790, the Chickamauga went into the Spanish domain of Tennessee, Arkansas, and Missouri. By 1808, the Cherokees were headed for the Spanish possessions in Mexico and Texas. In 1822, the new Republic of Mexico recognized these independent Cherokee separatists, who for four decades had not answered to the larger Cherokee groups in North Carolina and Georgia. Immigration deeper into Mexico, Coahuila, occurred in 1839 with the theft of Cherokee lands in East Texas by the anti-Houston government of Mirabeau Lamar, which resulted in 100 Cherokees being ethnically cleansed and placed in a mass grave. These Cherokees fought for land they had been settled on for three decades, long before Burnett, who immediately possessed and later sold the land, and Lamar, a prominent Georgia slaver and Cherokee hater, had ever considered coming to Texas to seek their fortune. If the idea of being Texan is being in the right with a just cause, and is not in reality determined by skin color, language, or ethnicity, then the only true Texans present were the poor Cherokee farmers who were slaughtered that day. The famous Texas Ranger Rip Ford arrived moments after a specially designated Texas militia soldier named Smith approached and shot Ugonwiyuhi Duwale, Chief Bowles. Thus, Chief Bowles lost his life with a bullet put through his head as he sat facing this Lamar-sponsored executioner who, in his lifetime, who would never measure up in any decent human currency to the old Cherokee chief. Chief Bowles was surrounded, wounded, unable to walk, and unarmed, having dropped his sword when his horse was shot from beneath him. Chief Bowles had chosen, without hesitancy, to be the last to leave that forced battlefield in order to allow his old people, women, and children to flee. This 72-year-old, pink-skinned, freckled, red-haired old chief, who spoke little English, had at one time fought for the United States, as did hundreds of other Cherokees alongside Davy Crockett against the Creeks in the Red Sticks War. Crockett suffered politically and lost his congressional seat and economic future for opposing Jackson in the U.S. Congress over the ethnic removal of his friends, the Cherokee. Crockett's opposition enraged Andrew Jackson, who in retaliation financed and supported Crockett's opponent's campaign with all of the political power and some of his own fortune, a fortune made by his personal purchase of Cherokee lands for a dollar an acre and then resold for up to $83 an acre to cartels seeking his favor so they'd be allowed to join in the exploitation. These many land flips by Jackson were for 640-acre sections. Sizable monies were involved. Texas Ranger Rip Ford was an avowed Indian-hating, pro-slavery, anti-union bigot, but he was an honest man who spoke his convictions openly. The ethnic removal in 1838 of the Cherokees from the eastern United States, coordinated simultaneously with the Republic of Texas oppression resulting in the bloody ethnic cleansing in East Texas. Rip Ford wrote, quote, "We gazed silently upon Bowles' body as it lay unburied. He is dressed rather in the American style, wearing a red silk vest, said to have been a gift from General Sam Houston. It's not difficult to accord him the deed of bravery, as I believe he sacrificed himself to save many of his people. Under other circumstances, history would have classed him among heroes and martyrs." End quote. You must respect the profound bravery of Rip Ford as he proved himself in many battles during his lifetime. He was a physician like myself, and his sincerity in his beliefs is beyond question. The other circumstances of history are here now. Sooner or later, Texas history will have to deal with the crimes against humanity which occurred during this ethnic cleansing of East Texas. Chief Bowles died clutching a tin box in his arms containing his people's written permission from Mexico, allowing them to be settled upon the very soil in which many Cherokees would be buried. Chief Bowles' body was never buried, but lay exposed to the elements for years. Chief Bowles also possessed a written opinion, which had been requested by Sam Houston, who was in Washington, D.C. at that time, from the Attorney General of the Republic of Texas. This opinion was a ruling in the Cherokees' favor as to their absolute legal right to the lands for which they were being slaughtered. History must also embrace the pure American courage exhibited by Chief Bowles and those early Cherokee Nation of Mexico settlers in defense of their homes. Homes they held legal title to, the same title from Mexico as was held by the Anglo settlers who that day slaughtered the Cherokee, many of whom were part Anglo, and the same title whose authenticity had been validated by the Attorney General of the Republic of Texas. This was just the beginning of the ignoble dark American decades to come, where huge political forces of big agriculture, which at that time could only exist with extensive slave labor, big agriculture would have to shun, at any human cost, the non-slaving republics of the northern United States and Mexico, where slavery had been abolished since 1821. For this reason, Texas had to be taken from Mexico. There have been several unsuccessful attempted migrations to Mexico by Cherokees. The first in 1836, when Chief John Ross asked permission to sell their lands in Indian Territory and move to Mexico, but was denied by the U.S. Secretary of War. They would not be allowed to do either, sell their land or move. When any group of people cannot sell their property or live where they wish, they are, in reality, being held in a form of arrest. In the case of the Cherokee, a prison without visible walls, unless you consider the line of garrisoned forts stretching across the southern border of Indian Territory, constantly monitoring their words and actions. In 1895, another visionary, Chief Bird Harris, sent Cherokees to Mexico and sought permission from the U.S. government to move there. Permission again did not come, and discouragement grew into inaction. Then in 1899, the Kituwa desperately scouted Mexico with a plan to move, but could not raise sufficient money. Like migratory birds, my family and I found the tomb of Sequoia and learned of his prophecy, quote, that a child would come and find the tomb, end quote, as did my son Charles, Adolejoski Rogers. When this occurred, the story told us Sequoia's spirit would come back to his people to help unite all Cherokees. Shortly after the discovery, the Cherokee Nation of Mexico received reaffirmation of its historic recognition. We feel that we are the fourth Cherokee tribe that has been prophesied by many Eastern, Western, and Kituwa Cherokee over the past 300 years, as necessary for the Cherokee people to spiritually unite. We wish no part of any other government other than mutual respect and peace. We wish for no part of any other Cherokee's physical property, such as government reparation for the United States Indian Removal Act. We feel that it would be wrong for us to consider any such conversion. But, as to our Cherokee property as heritage and blood, the right to group in tribe and nation, the right to self-govern in the oldest Cherokee traditions, yes, this is our and any other Cherokee's property, given to us by Unetlanahi, the provider, and it is inalienable. It's important to be proud of our mixed ancestry, to understand that a full blood is a U.S. legal definition, not existing in human genetics, and must be weighed against a history of several thousand years of biological admixture from Native Americans, from other tribes. For the Cherokee, these newcomers were so numerous that there was even a clan designated for their acceptance and training in Cherokee ways. Whole villages of refugee Natchez were accepted in Cherokee towns. All of which will probably soon be clarified by improvements in DNA testing. All of this must be taken into consideration, but should never be a substitute for living our life in the manner of Ayanwiya, a principal person, a Cherokee. From this, a Cherokee person should take immense pride to the point of being humbled. We of the Cherokee Nation of Mexico know that Sequoia could have developed the syllabary had he been a full-blood Cherokee instead of half. He could have developed such had he been a full German instead of half. But the fact is that Sequoia, also known as George Guess, did have a biological foot in both genetic worlds. He did what no other person has ever done, invented a writing system to go with a spoken language, thus bestowing upon his people the wonder gift of the ability to read and write their language in only a few months. My people and I, like Chief Bowles, are completely proud of being in both worlds. This is our strength. However, any person of good heart may use this formula of Sequoia's for strength if they intend to create good for their fellow man. A person of any race or combination of races can do this. Put simply, to be a principled person, which should be the goal of every Cherokee, is to have absolute understanding and the resulting wisdom that comes from the true acceptance and pride in what they've inherited. The proof of their actual acceptance of what is true is that they must then choose to go forth and do something good and decent with it in this world. Any person who will not work to do something good and decent is like a Cherokee clay vessel that has not yet been fired. Yes, its construction is Cherokee, but it is without purpose, only potential. Sequoia has taught us that a Cherokee is defined by his activism, in this case, the art of silversmithing, academia, and the politics of seeking freedom. His letter back to the Cherokees urging them to come to Mexico and join him and many others caused a huge investigation by the U.S. Army, headed by General Arbuckle. We possess the U.S. archives in which General Arbuckle accuses the entire Western Cherokee government of being part of the conspiracy. According to U.S. and Mexican Cherokee family stories and legends, Sequoia was arrested in Mexico by U.S. military agents. He escaped and returned to Hacienda, where he hid and eventually died from his weakened state. Sequoia suffered from tuberculosis and was well over 70 years of age. It is his activism and American love of freedom which defines his status not only as a Cherokee hero in our eyes, but an American hero. Those Cherokees who had gone before him influenced the path that Sequoia chose. If all of us work together for freedom, unity, and peace, we will surely influence those who come after us, as this is the white path, and has been law and the way among Cherokees for millennia. Welcome to our website. Join us on our white path of peace. Osio, our grandfather's most ancient stories tell us that we Cherokee were in Exodus and walked a great distance when we came to the ocean. With faith, we built rafts and crossed the ocean, coming from the east to the west, and established a life for ourselves in this new land of the Americas. About 1000 BC, a people from a rubber tree forest invaded eastern Mexico. The indigenous Mexicans called these newcomers the Olmec. They were people completely obsessed with magic. We avoided them by traveling to the north. Our Cherokee traditional stories interlock and agree with several of the ancient pre-Columbian Mayan and Mexican legends, which tell of a people arriving from the east who believed in a single, benevolent, providing God. Some of these travelers from the east had different coloration of eyes and skin shade. Some had beards. The Maya and other early Mexicans drew pictures of these people who wore hats and turbans, not unlike those that Cherokee have always worn and wear today. The Mexican legend said that these people would return in time. It is not known to this day which people or combination of peoples built the great pyramid city of the Valley of Mexico, but the Cherokees were living in Mexico at that time, as were the Tlamacanini, which means wise men, the ancient Mexican language. They were a pre-Columbian group of intellectuals, engineers, and astronomers who shared a common belief or connection with the Cherokee in that their religion also had only one God who was merciful, who had created all things, and who would provide what you needed, not necessarily what you wished. This ancient Mexican society, the Tlamatanini, was supremely rational and civilized, arguably even more civilized than the Greeks or Romans. Their society existed within different Mexican civilizations and were unfazed by the threat of a gallery of monster gods used to motivate and control the populace. In 1450 AD, they were centered at Texcoco. Cherokee migration legend tells of our exodus north 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, past the River of the Ferocious Ones, which we believe to be the Rio Grande River, where the cannibalistic Carrancos lived. In the mid-1800s, Stephen F. Austin saw this tribe in person and described them as very handsome and intimidating, with men averaging 7 feet in height and women 6 feet. The Cherokee pushed on to the big waters of the Mississippi, then onto the headwaters of the Ohio, where they built walled cities and huge mounds for burial. The Delaware came from the west, and with assistance from the Iroquois Federation, fought to remove the Cherokee for the time period of 7 chiefs, or approximately 200 years, before the Cherokee went east to the mountains and coast. The exodus was pressured by war to continue south, with the Cherokee arriving in the Georgia area in approximately 800 to 1000 AD. The first European or Spaniard to visit the Cherokee in the Georgia area was the explorer conquistador De Soto in 1540. His official writings astonishingly state that many of the Cherokee were light-skinned, while of course many were not. De Soto noted, quote, "Some with light brown and blonde hair, equal in coloration to some of my Spanish soldiers," end quote. Of the 100 or more indigenous tribes visited by this Spanish explorer, no other tribe would be noted for the great mystery of being racially mixed like the Cherokee. According to oral tradition and existing written history, we know we have been mixed for several thousand years. Cherokee chief Oconostota, whose forefathers had all been chiefs, had himself been chief for 60 years, when in 1782 he told Colonel Sevier about the Cherokee history of the Welsh people who had come in approximately 1100. The chief's story also agrees with the Welsh legend of Prince Maddox, who was said to have come with 10 shiploads of white people and settled on the Hiwassee River. The Cherokee fought with them, took prisoners, and negotiated the retreat of the Welsh, who joined the Mandan tribe on Mobile Bay. This is stated in an existing document dated 1808, which Colonel Sevier sent to Major Stoddard, who was trying to locate these racially mixed Indians. The first Cherokees to return to Mexico went in 1720 to the mountains of Coahuila. In 1822, a newly independent Republic of Mexico granted the Cherokees freedom and immigration rights to the eastern part of the Mexican province of Texas. 17 years later, in 1839, the United States began the anti-indigenous eastern ethnic removal of the Cherokee from their homelands of 1,000 years in Georgia, Tennessee, and North Carolina to reservations in Oklahoma. A hardship that killed thousands. This ethnic removal was only exceeded in injustice by the same anti-indigenous elements of the Republic of Texas government, who coveted the Cherokee 600,000 acres and began a western ethnic removal of over 1,000 Cherokee men, women, and children. The Cherokees were led by Chief Bowles, a white-skinned, freckled man with dark red hair, a powerfully built warrior with a fair and honest heart. He spoke little English. He and over 100 of his Cherokee brothers were killed in defense of their property that had been granted them by Mexico under the same legal process that Austin's Anglo settlers had received before the Texas Revolution. Cherokee families, who had been peacefully farming their land for almost two decades, were now in 1839 homeless and countryless, many orphaned or widowed. Before this ethnic cleansing, Sam Houston asked the Attorney General of the Republic of Texas for and received an opinion that stated that, quote, it would be illegal for the Cherokee land to be taken, end quote. Texas President Mirabeau Lamar ignored this legal opinion from his own government and ordered the ethnic cleansing to begin. Burnett carried it out militarily, and he personally received the Cherokee lands, which he sold to the public for a huge profit. Lamar had helped write the Indian Removal Act of 1828 in Georgia before coming to Texas to seek his fortune. He was an admitted Cherokee hater. The surviving Cherokees were arrested and faced with the captivity of the military reservation, but instead resisted and fled to the freedom of the Republic of Mexico. These refugee Cherokees asked the courageous Mexican leaders for help and were granted amparo, or political amnesty. They were granted permission and settled in the Mexican states of Coahuila, Chihuahua, Nuevo León, and Tamaulipas, with the majority choosing to settle in mountainous Coahuila, near the historic city of San Fernando, now known as Zaragoza. The most famous Cherokee in history to come and live in the freedom of Coahuila, Mexico, was Sequoia. This world-famous educator is the only person in human history to develop a written system of syllables, which enabled all Cherokees to be able to write their language proficiently after only 2 months of study. For this work of genius, the Great Sequoia was featured in every U.S. newspaper and most major world publications. He was a U.S. Army veteran, known, honored, and loved in his time by the red and white band throughout the United States. To this day, U.S. national parks and giant redwood trees bear his name. For his achievements, he was given a house and a yearly monetary pension for the rest of his life in the military-controlled Indian Territory. Yet, he loved and valued freedom so much that he urged all Cherokees to live as a free people in Coahuila, Mexico. Indeed, earlier, in 1836, Chief John Ross had been denied permission by the U.S. Secretary of War to be allowed to sell the Cherokee lands and move the entire tribe to Mexico. Much later in 1895, the Western Cherokees would consider a vote to move to Mexico, to when Sequoia had moved in 1842. Immediately upon Sequoia's arrival in Mexico, the anti-indigenous elements of the 1842 government of the Republic of Texas, who feared Sequoia's intellect, celebrity influence, and pro-Native American activist presence in Mexico, pressured authorities to dispatch agents that covertly and illegally entered Mexico. Without the process of law and under threat of force, they arrested Sequoia, who, even at 73 years of age and suffering from a severe lung infection, managed to suddenly disappear, escaping his captors while crossing the Rio Grande River at night. Sequoia, fighting collapse, persevered and returned to Zaragoza, where the kind-hearted Mexican people of that city and the Patiños Rodriguez Salinas families of the nearby hacienda, who had all grown to love the venerable Sequoia, bravely and without consideration for their own personal safety, hid him in a secret cave. Sequoia, who had been very ill for some time, became exhausted from this struggle and flight from captivity to his freedom. The great Sequoia died peacefully, a free person, among some of his Cherokee family and many Mexican friends, but not before prophesying that a Cherokee child would someday come, find his grave, and bring his spirit of brotherhood back to the Cherokee and all other people of good heart. According to the legends of both Western Cherokee and Mexican Cherokee, Sequoia believed with all of his being that Mexico was the ancient land in which our ancestors felt there was a source of knowledge and power. Like a migratory bird, he was determined to return to freedom, even if he perished in this quest. After Sequoia's passing, 70 Cherokee warriors fought during the 1842 conflicts in an attempt to reclaim their land. 17 Cherokee died. On August 4, 2001, President Vicente Fox historically signed Mexican constitutional amendments to reflect the legal presence and protected cultural status of all of the indigenous people of Mexico. This profound act of respect for indigenous cultures by the Republic of Mexico is unique among all countries of the world. On August 22, 2001, the Cherokee Nation and Tribe of Mexico petitioned Coahuila Governor Enrique Martinez y Martinez to confirm through formal recognition the strong continuing bond that exists between the Cherokees and the Mexicans. Governor Martinez y Martinez acted without hesitation to extend the hand of continuing friendship and ancient brotherhood with formal recognition of the Cherokee. In the same courageous Mexican spirit as the governor of Coahuila in 1839 and the president of Mexico in 1822. Cherokees come in many colors, and we feel that this is one of our strengths, which allows us to understand and respect all humans as brothers. Thank you. Bueno. People in Exodus by Chief Charles Jeflovi Rogers, the Cherokee Nation of Mexico. I will tell you a true thing. Since 1 BC, there has not been a Christian who does not tell of Jesus by using that very same name. Since 500 AD, there has not been a Muslim who does not tell of Muhammad by using that very same name. In 1750, the Cherokees knew Jesus and God by five commonly accepted Old Testament names, yet knew nothing of the New Testament name, Jesus. Where and how did the Cherokees obtain such ancient knowledge? When asked, upon first contact with Europeans, they replied, directly from God. Cohida, a long time ago, we Cherokee knew long before the good Apostle John that whatever is true is from Munaithlanahi, the one creator of all things, God. You needn't bow to other human permission to believe in anything you believe to be true. As a Cherokee, it is your responsibility to do so without fear, for this is the most traditional way of the Cherokee. The one God of the Cherokee was not the vengeful God of a small tribe of war-loving people. The one God in whom the Cherokee believe is benevolent and has no specific chosen people. Of all living things, only people have been chosen by God in that they were created with the ability to choose their path. The path to God is by using their heart, soul, and mind for that which is good, to be a good or godly person, a principled person, whom the Cherokee called Ayahuila. To strive to become Ayahuila is to acknowledge the desire by a Cherokee to become a principled person, but they must first choose God's white path of peace, which is what the ancient Cherokees sought. They saw themselves as children of God. "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." Cherokees spoke the Old Testament names for Jesus thousands of years before he appeared 2,000 years ago. However, this early knowledge does not give privilege, only the responsibility which all of the Creator's human creations have and share, which is to move toward God in goodness, in thought, and action. Of course, some individuals, groups, or nations may choose the opposite. All histories, written and oral, of all peoples, show the drastic cost of human actions based on divine right, skin coloration, religious differences, and the belief that you are chosen and thus released from responsibility of being civilized, which is to treat others as you want to be treated, or in the words of the New Testament, to love thy neighbor as thyself. Approximately 3,500 to 4,000 years ago, Cherokee legends say they were visited by a spiritual being who taught these principled people how to live in peace with animals and humans, and how to have the proper respect for nature. The legend has caused many Cherokee and other people to believe that it was Christ, or a manifestation of someone like him who chose to appear, giving instructions and prophecies to the Cherokee people. Is this possible? If we compare it to the similarity of the accounts of God appearing or making himself known unto men in the Old Testament Christian Bible, then we can only agree that the legend of the Cherokee people is possibly accurate and true. Because this instruction is widely believed to have already occurred once in human history, another appearance to other humans is less difficult to understand and believe, as there is supporting evidence of tribal stories exactly like the Old Testament Bible within several Semitic tribes, and globally in many indigenous tribes. Remember that all things true are not contained within the Bible, which is not to say that what is in the Bible is not true. A map of the United States is not in the Bible. It's not relevant to the core message of the Bible. The historical Bible setting only allows the reader to better understand the intended message. Thus, the ancient Cherokees sang, spoke, and chanted, as was heard and documented by several Europeans as late as 1755, the names Shiloh, head of all things, Yehovah, the son of righteousness, and the morning star. They were using names or titles that were both Old Testament and Cherokee religious words or phrases for God. These Cherokee words are considered by most modern Bible scholars as also being Old Testament names for Jesus, used before his coming. And in that time before the New Testament said that the angel first said his name, Jesus Christ, to Mary, the mother of Jesus. In Cherokee, God was called B'nefanahi, the creator of all things. The other five names were also used to describe God, or the spiritual person the Cherokees believed that he sent to earth to instruct them. These ancient Cherokee religious words and teachings, as practiced and followed by the ancient Cherokee, were apparently from a time period of between 500 B.C., when the Jewish tribes, one of several Semitic language groups, first obtained the ability to read and write in Aramaic, and started writing down what we call the Old Testament, and 4000 B.C., with the story of Noah, which was known by all of these Semitic language tribes, both Jewish and non-Jewish, first appeared in Semitic writings, the Gilgamesh Scrolls. The second oldest known writing of the story of Noah and flood is in India. Clearly, these stories are the actual and physical property of mankind, not of any specific group, from the beginning of history, which was oral tradition before writing came into being. The ancient Cherokee also knew what a swine was before the Europeans imported such, and had a prohibition against eating swine and many other foods considered unclean. Cherokees would keep one day without work for prayer. Cherokee would marry only outside of their clan. A Cherokee woman could divorce her husband without physical violence to her. Other tribes cut off ears or burnt her. Cherokees apparently had New Testament compassion. When a man died, His wife could be taken as a second wife after a passage of time by a surviving brother of the deceased husband, which is exactly the process documented by several different Semitic tribes in the Old Testament. Also occurring approximately 3,500 to 4,000 years ago, the Cherokee language separated from the Iroquois language group and stayed separated because the vast majority of Cherokee words changed radically with the addition of new words, logically because of the integration with some other people and their language. This explains why other indigenous groups, for example, in the Iroquois family of languages, do not have the same belief system, which includes Old Testament words and concepts in their ancient religious practices. All people bring language, culture, and religious beliefs with them. Where did the Cherokee obtain these early Old Testament names for Jesus? But most importantly, not use or know the actual New Testament name of Jesus. There is no Christian missionary of any Christian church that did not or does not teach the name Jesus Christ. Yet the Cherokee used five other commonly accepted Old Testament names for Jesus. Some Muslim groups have recently claimed early contact with North American native people. But what Muslim does not speak of Muhammad? Christians talk about Jesus, Muslims about Muhammad. It's the mandatory core of their belief. Thus, logic and common sense would dictate these choices, that the Cherokee received into its tribe a people who brought these Old Testament words and concepts with them from outside the Americas, that the Cherokee received such instruction and knowledge directly from Unetlanahi, the creator of all things, or that they were received from Jesus, even though they didn't use his New Testament name, who brought these names and instruction from God to the Cherokees. The written historical records of the ancient Cherokees claim that all three of the above scenarios are exactly what occurred. Also consider that the oldest Cherokee migration story reflects that they traveled over land a great distance, came to the ocean, built rafts, and crossed. They landed and then went west, north, and south. Please note that a Pacific crossing upon arriving in the Western Americas cannot go west, only east, north, and south. Logic, geography, and oral tradition support the opposite. An Atlantic crossing of some tribe of people who may have considered themselves a principal people, who knew the one God who was benevolent and taught forgiveness, and who was against human or live animal sacrifices or cannibalism, as reflected in actual ancient Cherokee law. Different physical traits existed and were documented within the Cherokee. Variation in eye and skin colors, straight and curly hair, facial hair among the men, which makes them somewhat generally different from most other Native American groups. In 1541, Comandante Alva, under Herman de Soto, first historically documented, but not the actual first Europeans to see the Cherokee, wrote that many of the Cherokee were as fair-skinned and blonde as the Spanish soldiers under him. Of course, in North America, the majority were a handsome reddish-bronze cast. Only the Cherokees, Mayans, and Incans had a word for the number 1,000. No other Native American groups had this concept. 1,000 in Cherokee was called the Ancient Ones 100, meaning that their ancestors had at one time higher mathematic capabilities than the Cherokee of the mid-1700s, when this ancient Cherokee phrase was historically documented. Other differences included the ritual practice of daily bathing, going to water regardless of the weather, not unlike the Essenes, who also religiously bathed. The Cherokee also had an ark, a chest containing sacred items, and they built mounds with temples atop. The Cherokees were the only intact surviving Native American group to have been documented as living on a mound at the headwaters of the Ohio River. This is seen by the writings of the Wollum Olum, which is a history of the Delaware people who fought the Cherokee for this land for over a period of 160 years, ending in approximately 700 A.D. Unlike most of the mound builders who practiced ritualistic cannibalism, the Cherokee had strict laws concerning such, in that they would put to death, before the sun that day went down, anyone caught practicing it, inside or outside the tribe. The Cherokee word for cannibal in English is raven mocker. You will find this in the oldest Cherokee stories. However, the old stories are merely vehicles for remembering the law. When a Cherokee is asked, even in this present time, whether part blood or full blood, if they strictly consider themselves subjectively a Native American and or something else, a great many of these Cherokees will reply that being Cherokee is being something else, or Native American plus something else. Also consider that the Cherokees had three actual cities of refuge. They had stories of the flood and many other Old Testament stories, and that they also had the prohibitions found within the Ten Commandments. Ancient Cherokees didn't know Jesus by that name, but they said in 1750 that they knew God was to appear on earth as a man, and they called this person by five different Old Testament names for Jesus. The Cherokee language is, in structure, like the Iroquois language. However, almost all of the words are different. Osio in Cherokee means hello. Kasio in Sanskrit, the oldest mother language of all European, East Indian, Arabic, and Semitic languages, also means hello. In prehistoric times, there were Africans in Central and Southern America, called the Olmecs, who apparently traveled from Africa to Central America. Whether they were lost or simply superb seafarers is not known, but they did have what appears to be a magnetic compass with them, predating the Egyptians by 2,700 years. If one group of people can make that journey, why not another? And if another people did so, would they not, due to favorable ocean currents being absolutely necessary for such a journey, be from an area which could be the Mediterranean coast, the Canary Islands, Egypt, or the Middle East, which are close to these black Africans who colonized Central America and southern Mexico? Remember that these are the areas north of Africa, where tribal stories say that God is said to have spoken to man, as is believed by Christians, Jews, and Muslims. These are the exact same religious stories which are in the first four books of the Old Testament, that are today read and believed by Muslims, Jews, and Christians, almost a billion people. In the writings, journals, and reports of various renowned missionaries to the Cherokee people, we learn the Cherokees had religious beliefs that were much more compassionate than the ways of many white men that had come over to Cherokee country from Europe. Their religious festivals, although different from the ways of the world outside the Cherokee nation, reflected their love for one another and devotion to the one author of creation, God. The Cherokee people, by any standard or measure of civilized values, were not uncivilized savages, as portrayed by popular media and even some missionaries who had labored under denomination blindness. The Cherokees occupied a large percentage of this great land. America was as much their land as the Promised Land was to the Semitic tribes, or earlier peoples, as recorded in the Bible. Like all good tribes, the Cherokee people fought with a vengeance to keep their property, whether land or culture, with both the Europeans and, long before them, with other Native American tribes, when they and their religions encroached. Eventually, the Cherokee people became once again a people in Exodus. The Trail of Tears from the eastern U.S. to Indian Territory was Exodus number 6 in Cherokee history. The first Exodus was the migration myth. The second Exodus was from an island in the south going to the north. The third Exodus was from a Cherokee city mound at the headwaters of the Ohio. The fourth was from the Atlantic seaboard south to Georgia and North Carolina. The fifth was when 25% of the tribe left for Mexico in 1720. The sixth was the Trail of Tears to Indian Territory in 1838 to 39. The seventh Exodus will be, as Sequoyah prophesied, when all Cherokees come back together and form Ketuah, which was told to me by a Cherokee holy man from Tahlequah, Oklahoma, who is now in heaven. Ketuah is an old sacred pronunciation of the number 14, which means the seventh heaven of the seventh heaven, a cross between Eden and Shangri-La, a place of harmony and peace. The ways of other Native Americans and the white men would, over the course of time, transform their culture and cause them to almost lose the fragments of their noble ancient beliefs. At this writing, the Cherokee people are just starting to move back together. The name for Cherokee people is Aniyanwiya, which in English means the principal people, or akin to the people of God. The devotion of the Cherokee people was to the Supreme Holy Spirit, who couldn't be looked upon and whose energy was the fire of all creation and all of life, and who resided in the heavens and on earth to purify people. They were rigidly non-idolaters and wouldn't observe any religious images among them or keep idolatrous religious ceremonies. Instead, the Cherokee people adored the one great spirit, God, who they described as the only giver and taker of life. They were devoted to a higher principled way of living, according to their ancient religious beliefs of the one benevolent God. The Cherokees believed the sole author of creation was with them, and they with God, by his blessing of mankind with animals and all plant and vegetable life. Their religious worship very closely paralleled the Mosaic institution in the Old Testament of the Bible. They weren't pagans and were warned each year by their priests, just as the Old Testament warns about, quote, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared by a hot iron. Paganism is when people worship processes instead of the Creator, God Himself. Pagan means someone who is ignorant of God. The Cherokees never gave special adoration or worship to any images, dead men, evil spirits, extraterrestrial luminaries, or any human-created being or personage. A body would be buried before the sun went down, time permitting. First, detractors from other Native American tribes, then the European Westerners, tended to believe the myth that the religion of the Cherokee Indians was no more than primitive emotion and pagan tradition. Conflict came because time and time again the Cherokee people believed completely in protecting their land, their people, and their mono-deity beliefs. These ancient Cherokee religious beliefs were at the very heart of the Cherokee Nation. They bowed to no man nor kissed any idol, for they believed this was God's direct instruction. In the 1700s, according to James Adair, who lived and studied among them and spoke their language, the Cherokee did not even believe the sun was any bigger than it appeared to the naked eye. And neither did they, nor could they be made to, lay prostrate or bow to the sun, or to any one other or any other object whatsoever. They bowed only when they were making a mutual peace or renewing peace with outsiders, or in their religious dances, honoring God. In the 1700s, there was no evidence that the Cherokee tribes or people were involved in the pagan religious animism, the religion based on fear that was the most common among ancient primitive peoples. Animism causes people to fear vengeful spirits that live in rocks, mountains, trees, wind, rain, fire, and other elements of the earth. This fear causes them to offer live sacrifices and bow down to the sun as a god in order to set themselves free from these lurking evil spirits. Cherokees, however, prayed to the one God of creation in all four principal directions, not as was done by some other Native Americans, by praying to the four directions, to the Cherokee a direction was for geographical use, not to be prayed to. In the Old Testament, Ezekiel witnessed animism. He found 25 men on the porch of the temple in Jerusalem bowing to worship the sun. God said to Ezekiel, "Have you seen this, O son of man? It is a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here. For they have filled the land with violence. Then they have returned to provoke me to anger." The Romans and most other Native American tribes had gods that numbered in the thousands. When we look as far back as the 1600s, there still existed one minority sect of the Cherokee people who declared there existed three entities above, who were always joined together in action and spirit, and were of the same mind. It is said that these three entities were always one in sentiment, in thought and action. They created all things and governed all things. The three entities sat on white seats above, and all prayers were to be directed toward them. They had helpers and messengers known as angels, who came to earth to help attend the affairs of men. The Cherokees believed that in the beginning this trinity of entities created all creatures in creation to be harmless, as in Eden. In the Bible we learn that God is triune, three entities in one supreme being, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. When comparing the account of the beginning of time with the account the Cherokees gave, we discover that when God created the heavens and the earth, he was not alone. In Genesis it says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.'" So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." The human brain is, of course, divided into two major physical components. However, the human spirit is intangible yet powerful enough to change reality on this world. We are in three parts within one being also. According to the Cherokee beliefs, in the beginning, the three faces of the one God above employed 7 days in the work of creation. The world was created at the first appearance of the autumn new moon, when the fruits were ripe. They believed the moon began a lunar year and was called the Great Moon, from which all of the feasts of the new moon would come. The Creator made man from red earth and blew into his mouth, causing him to be a living soul. The first man was red. The ancient Cherokees believed that infants became living souls from the moment they breathed in their first breath. The Creator then perceived that man was lonely, so he took one of the man's ribs and made woman. The first woman, like the first man, was red. Thus the red people were the first real people, as their name Aniyanwiya indicated. Cherokees believed that at first serpents were not poisonous, and neither were any roots or plants. Man would have lived forever, as man was to eat plants only, but in time he began to eat animals. Animals would kill humans by giving them disease and violence. Plants came to help men with medicine. Soon the earth wasn't large enough to support forever all who had been born. After this, the whole race was doomed to the physical death of the body. Not long after creation, Yehovah ordered men to build high mounds on which to erect structures of worship, to offer gifts or sacrifices of food, to assemble for religious instruction, and to perform their religious dances. He commanded them not to despise the lame, the blind, or the deformed. They were forbidden to laugh at the misfortunate, but to be kind to them and strangers. And if they owned any kind of creatures, they must be kind and treat them well as well. The oldest parts of the Old Testament's first four books existed within various people or tribes thousands of years before their adoption, interpretation, and rewriting by the priests of Israel in 500 B.C. These early stories belong not only to all Semitic people, including the Jewish people, but also to anyone else who wrote or spoke such stories. For example, the story of the deluge or flood of Noah is found worldwide in native peoples, including the Americas, as told by hundreds of tribes to their first European visitors. To say that this is not their legacy is thievery by those thinking it is their divine right of being a chosen people to rewrite and claim all other indigenous tribal peoples' cultural property. All people have a right to their God-given property, life, land, and faith, and thus the cultural property of their stories of faith concerning their relationship with God. Among Cherokees, it's civilized to be our brother's keeper, certainly not the keeper of our brother's cultural and religious inheritance. In the Bible, we see a parallel to the account of the beginning of time by the Cherokee people, as can be seen in Genesis chapters 1 through 6. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. In Genesis 1:26-31, it says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created them. Male and female he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.' And God said, 'See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the sea, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food.' And so it was. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day." Genesis 2:1-3 says, "Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made." Genesis 2:18-22 says, "And the Lord God said, 'It is not good that man should be alone. I shall make him a helper comparable to him.' Out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. So Adam gave names to all the cattle, to the birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam. And as he slept, he took one of his ribs, closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib, which the Lord God had taken from first man, he made into woman and brought her to the man." Genesis 3:1-7 says, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God hath made. And he said to the woman, Has God indeed said, You shall not eat of every fruit of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, We may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. Then the serpent said to the woman, You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings." Genesis 3:8-14 says, "And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. Then the Lord God called to Adam and said to him, Where are you? So he said, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. And he said, Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat? Then the man said, The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I ate. And the Lord said to the woman, Was it this you have done? The woman said, The serpent deceived me, and I ate." Deception and or ignorance abound. Judge this and all such thoughts with both your heart and your mind. Cherokee people were obedient to Yehovah and assembled for worship at the structures they were commanded to erect. They met early in the morning. When the people were all seated and silent, the priest, known as the Uku, would commence his speech. The Uku would command the Cherokees to obey Yehovah in every respect, telling people they must do all that he directed them to do and to never disobey him secretly, because they were never alone, because Yehovah was with them. They were never to indulge in idle or vain conversation, or call anyone wicked names. They were to abstain from all lewdness and polygamy. Children were to be hard-working and obedient to their parents. Among the Cherokee, there were 7 clans or 7 families that did not intermingle with one another. The clans were distinguished by the different color feathers fastened to the rims of their ears. Each clan was a descendant of one family and one bloodline, and was forbidden to intermarry. One myth says there were originally 12 tribes of Indians, but after a while one of the tribes violated the law of Yehovah by intermarrying. Therefore, the tribes were reduced to 7 and were scattered north, south, and west. Once again, they were as far east on land as physically possible, showing that they had come from the east into the Americas. Exodus 20:2-21 says, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the 3rd and 4th generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the 7th day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God has given you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, "You speak with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die." And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin." Liuku taught that if the Cherokee were obedient, when they died, they would experience eternal life and dwell with Yehovah forever. However, if they were disobedient, they would be eternally miserable in a lake of fire. It is therefore evident from the ancient teachings of the priests that Cherokee people believed in a heaven and a hell. Revelations 21, 5-8 in the Bible says, "Write, for these words are true and faithful." And he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." John Howard Payne, in his Cherokee Papers, wrote in the early 1800s of an old Cherokee man named Raven, who was 100 years old. Raven told him that when he was a small boy, he used to hear the elders predicting the destruction of the world after 4 generations. At that time, the Supreme Being would cause a storm to rise out of the east, raining itch until everything was covered with it. Showers of fire would then follow, setting everything ablaze, consuming the entire world. This would indicate a knowledge of Scripture prior to the arrival of the missionaries. The Apostle Peter in the Christian Bible also gives us a description of the end of time in 3, chapters 10 to 18. "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless, and account that the long-suffering of our Lord is salvation, as also our beloved brother Paul, according to the wisdom given to him, has written to you, as also in all his epistles, speaking in them of these things, in which are some things hard to understand, which untaught and unstable people twist in their own destruction, as they do also the rest of the scriptures. You therefore, beloved, since you know this beforehand, beware lest you also fall from your own steadfastness, being led away with the error of the wicked, but grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. To him be the glory both now and forever. Where did the Cherokee people get their knowledge of the Great Spirit, God? One of the ancient stories tells of a certain exemplary Cherokee man who, having fasted for 7 days, went to the top of a high mountain during a rainstorm. And there he saw with his own eyes the thunder beings and the place where they come from. From the beginning of time, God has always had a witness on the earth. God made his presence known to Abraham in order to make a covenant with him, to have a witness on earth of his supreme glory. Abraham was an idolater when God appeared to him to reveal his glory. By the grace of God, Abraham turned away from vain idols to walk with God, the creator of all things, which is also the Cherokee's concept. The New Testament states that by faith, Abraham believed, and because of his obedience to the great supreme being, God promised, quote, "I will show you, I will make you, and I will bless you," end quote. The Old Testament gives accounts of God appearing to Abraham again and again to build faith in his heart, to make a covenant with him, and to prompt him to obedience to fulfill the promise even when it seemed impossible. Another account to be noted from the Old Testament is when God appeared to Moses face to face, as shown in Exodus 33, verse 11. Quote, "The Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend," end quote. Moses also encountered God on a mountaintop, where he received the Ten Commandments for God's people. Anyone can sit down among a primitive people that has never heard of God or the teachings of Jesus Christ and find out that they know right from wrong. You can ask a man, "What do you do if another man tries to take your wife?" And he will answer, "I will attack him. It is wrong to take another man's wife." Missionaries have witnessed, even among the most primitive cultures on the face of the earth, people living in a conscientious dispensation, which is when people feel that God is among them. From the scriptures in the Christian Bible, we also learn that men know God from conscience and creation, but have refused to honor him. The greatest judgment God can inflict on us is to let us have our own way. As we can clearly see in Romans 1, verses 20 to 26, we are called to consider the work of our Creator. Right before our very eyes, we behold nothing more obvious than the creation of God's wisdom and power. All of mankind is a witness to what God has done and is doing on the earth. Every human can see afar off the heavens in all its glory, the work of omnipotence. For since the creation of his world, his, God, invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanliness, in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Scientists are still trying to figure out the production created by the very finger of God. The eternal power of the Godhead is clearly seen and understood by the things that are made. Every person who has not received divine revelation of Jesus Christ may see that God exists. There is no speech or voice of a preacher not heard today. Creation is seen in all its glory, splendor, beauty, and excellence. It cannot be denied that this is truly the work of God, the author of all things. Although one may not personally know God, surely we are witness to his power and perfection by what we see in all creation. Greatly should he be praised and magnified, and be reverentially feared, because he is the giver of the breath of life. The supreme being of all creation has all power of heaven and earth. Therefore, in humility and reverence, all mankind should adore and give honor to the Great Spirit, God. He can open the windows of heaven and cause rain to fall on the crops of the just and unjust. In the heat of the day, he can call the clouds in to perform a canopy called spreading of the clouds to protect his people. Lucy Wananohi wrote, "The Cherokees believed in one God whom they called Unaithlinahi, the maker of all things, and Galunthlati Ehi, the one who lives above. They acknowledged God as their friend and believed he had unlimited power and was the creator of all things made." Wananohi also stated that the Cherokees believed there was an evil spirit, whom they called Skeena. They believed Skeena was malicious in influence, and the cause of all trouble, calamity, and sickness. The word was already in the Cherokee language. Prior to the late 1600s, many Christian missionaries didn't believe there were such things as an evil spirit, the devil, or universal spirit called Satan. Nor was there any correspondence in Cherokee theology. The zenith of this new concept of evil was evidenced by the Salem witch trials in 1692, when mass hysteria took over this small New England village. Since then, for many people, the devil has become more real. Wananohi derived her connotation of the devil from the Cherokee New Testament, which was translated into Cherokee in the early 1800s. Satan had many names in the Christian Bible that ranged from evil spirit, the devil, lying spirit, serpent, and wicked one, to power of darkness. There are many accounts in the Bible of the devil causing sickness, disease, trouble, and calamity. The Cherokees also attributed disease to the patient's body, having been tricked into illness by something bad existing in the patient's mind, or in his nutritional habits. Once explained in this manner, the patient would understand and the body would correct the health imbalance. Correct and clean nutrition and prevention were taught daily. In John Howard Payne's writing of the Cherokee beliefs, he also included extensive duplications of the first five books of the Bible, which caused readers to conclude that early in the historic period, the Cherokees began to weave the newly learned biblical materials into the origins of the legends. Nevertheless, the ancient beliefs and stories vary slightly, perhaps because they were not rewritten so much. To some extents, in the Christian Bible. Regardless of Payne's study, the Cherokee people attributed their existence to the Creator. They built their religious belief upon foundations and pillars built by the express creations of God and not of men, and they were reserved as such. The Cherokee people held on to the fragments of their beliefs for many centuries. The chief supreme being believed in by the Cherokees of the 18th century was the same mysterious being or being beyond human comprehension, which would always be a mystery to man, Yehovah, whom the more ancient Cherokees had said was both God and king, appearing sometimes on earth as a man. Yehovah taught the first hymn called Yowah to the first Cherokee priest or ministers, known as the Office of the Uku. Over time, the song was described as being part of the old language and was no longer understood. Some of the old language words were still employed in the song in the 19th century. Only those chosen by the Uku could perform the song after undergoing rigorous testing, which included abstinence from food and sex, and the fulfilling of special observances of prayer, purification, and vigils. The Christian Bible warns, quote, "Gather up the fragments that remain, so nothing is lost," end quote. Fragments represent the evidence of the awesome miracles that our Creator has performed on behalf of His people. They are the glorious things God has performed in our lives. The Cherokees also had a sacred ark that carried the sacred fires and other holy things, which were the fragments of their religious beliefs, fragments that represented the everlasting bond between the Creator and the Cherokee people. During the time of Moses, it's recorded that ancient Israel had poor memory and often forgot about the great works of God and would not wait for His counsel. Like ancient Israel, over a period of time, the Cherokees slowly began to forget the fragments of their ancient religious beliefs. There were many accounts and revisions to the mortality story. One could only speculate that through time, the Cherokees' memory became poor and much of their ancient beliefs were lost. Modifications to the stories over the years have led to doubt and confusion. The Christian Bible says that God is not the author of confusion. The Creator made it clear to the Cherokee people that changes or modifications of the ancient beliefs were only profitable if they were progressing and continuing in their beliefs. However, if the modifications were attempts to conform to popular belief, they would experience disastrous results in their religion and government. Over time, the religious festivals of the Cherokee people became obsolete. However, the festivals continued to show their devotion to the Creator and the keeping of His commandments. It was a time when they fasted, prayed, and gave thanksgiving offerings of the fruits to the Maker of all things, a time of cleansing and purification from the old, so Yehovah could bring in the new, still a universal law found in many religions. The old fires were put out, and new sacred fires were placed in every home. The new fires represented cleansing, rebuilding, and enlightenment. Another ancient tradition says that Yehovah commanded the people to rest from all work on the seventh day, and to show their adoration for Him by holding their hands entirely still while they rested with their palms open and upward on their knees. The people were to confine themselves to talk about the Supreme Being that dwells on high on the seventh day. Most historians tend to deal with the political aspects of the Cherokee culture. The white men recognized that religion, or wanting to live good lives rather than politics, was at the core of the ancient Cherokee life. In time, the fragments of the Cherokee ancient beliefs would be lost, as the whites cunningly planned to pierce the Cherokee religion so erosion would set in. White men wanted to capitalize on the Indians. The Cherokees had become a grand and glorious people of influence and prosperity. They knew nothing about the outside world or what was going on in it, and they decided they wanted to learn what they could from the white man's ways. What started out innocently turned out to be a conversion to the white man's manner of life. Soon, the fragments of their ancient beliefs would be lost in the transformation of their culture. Although the whites enjoyed trade with the Cherokees, conflicts over land and money would often occur. Eventually, the Cherokees became outnumbered and outgunned, and they didn't have any other alternative but to accept what came their way, due to the fact that by then the old religion was being practiced by only 40% of the people. A larger consensus would have equaled power to resist negative changes. They became a people of uncertainty. In doubt and confusion, some of the clans began to let the whites guide them as trusting children. Some Cherokees didn't permit their clans to marry outsiders, but the full bloods began to be persuaded by the whites and mixed bloods, which caused further altering of their festival procedures and, more importantly, the practical training for these ceremonies. For example, the Green Corn Festival originally taught the young men to publicly proclaim their work for and support of their mothers. Remember, this was before Social Security or government support. The mixed bloods soon began to outnumber the full bloods. As they increased in number, the power of the Cherokee religion declined. The mixed blood parents convinced the young Cherokees that the old ways, of which they themselves were ignorant, were heathen, without even knowing that they were rejecting a legacy of direct contact with God. The children soon began to stray away from the ritual lifestyle, while the full blood held on to their personal convictions, even though diluted and fragmented. Ultimately, everything about the Cherokee people became so modified and confused, the old ways began to lose their appearance of having any effectiveness whatsoever. In 1736, a Jesuit named Christian Priber spent 9 years with the Cherokee people. His mission was both political and religious. He gained great favor and influence with tribal leaders. He became the unofficial secretary to the principal headman. Nevertheless, he served both the church and the French government. His primary goal was to disrupt tribal relations between the Cherokees and the English traders and colonists. Eventually, though, he was captured and imprisoned by the English. Later, the Catholic Church made attempts to work as missionaries among the Cherokee people. Their efforts to convert and educate were unsuccessful until more contemporary times. In 1740, Cherokees obtained their first horses, and a trail was opened between Augusta, Georgia, and the Cherokee country. 20 years later, the Cherokees possessed large herds of horses, and by 1775, each Cherokee man owned anywhere from 2 to 12 mounts. They obtained cattle, hogs, and domesticated bees. The Cherokees were already farming many European fruits, vegetables, and domesticated potatoes, and trading for coffee. In the late 18th century, the English brought over spinning wheels and looms along with farming tools, and gradually, the Cherokee people were becoming part of the white man's world. To the east of the Cherokee settlements were the English, to the west were the French, and to the south were the Spanish. All three competed for trade advantages and for every piece of land on which they could get their hands. Finally, the cooperative trading efforts of the Cherokee became obsolete. Skins and textiles were no longer accepted as exchange for goods. The whites now had currency. Not long afterwards, the economic system of the Indians collapsed. In the forests, wild game began to disappear as the whites grew in population and power. Even fishing became subject to strict restrictions set in motion by the whites. The Cherokees' efforts to raise livestock became limited by regulations. The whites began to take charge of lumbering the forests, mining the land, excavating the ground for chemical interests, and taking charge of the water streams and lakes by building dams, flooding valleys where Cherokee homesteads had once stood. The white man's government was changing as well. The clan tribal loyalty was compromised by the demands of a newly formed Republican government. The French and the English became rivals. Immediately, both sides acted to pull the Cherokees apart. Although the French were diplomatic, the English were able to supply guns and ammunition, as well as other militant resources the Cherokees desired. By the mid-1700s, the French were losing control to the British, and the Cherokee leaders of Virginia, North Carolina, and Georgia were being pitted against one another. Some Cherokees understood what was happening and sought to turn the tables on the foreigners. In the last half of the 18th century, the whites began a rivalry for tribal control between the leaders of the great towns of Tellico and Chota. The Cherokees were kept in a constant state of turmoil, their way of life becoming forever interrupted by the ways of the New World. Throughout the late 18th century, tribal leader Atikulakula controlled tribal policy by learning the import ways of the white colonization and began guiding tribal policy away from the old ways of Cherokee life. He encouraged the Cherokees to cooperate more closely with the white settlers. During Atikulakula's tribal reign, farming replaced hunting as the dominant economic factor. The wars between tribes stopped. He also bargained for colonial forts and military garrisons to protect the Cherokees from warring neighbors, but none of Atikulakula's efforts resolved the Cherokee problems. Their settlements were always in the way of relentless white settlers, which resulted in waves of war from 1756 to 1794, during which many Cherokee settlements were annihilated. Taindo, the sister of Atikulakula, gave birth to a daughter named Nancy. Nancy grew up and married the noted war leader, Kingfisher of the Dare clan. She was at his side in 1755 when he was killed by Creek warriors in the Battle of Taliwa. Nancy immediately picked up his weapons and inspired the Cherokee warriors to an overwhelming victory. Chota chose her to fulfill the vacant position of a beloved woman. The Cherokees believed that the Supreme Being spoke to the people through beloved women. They were also given the power and authority to make decisions on what to do with prisoners of war. Nancy also headed up an influential women's council that consisted of a representative from each Cherokee clan, and she sat as a voting member on the Council of the Chiefs. Later, she married a white leader named Bryant Ward, but after 10 years of marriage, he returned to his white wife and children in South Carolina. Numerous settlements had been founded in Cherokee country, which was a direct violation of the Royal Decree of England. And when the Revolutionary War broke out, the Cherokees sided with the English. They attacked the frontier settlements of Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia. 700 warriors attacked the settlers of Watauga. Nancy Ward helped Isaac Thomas and two other white men escape from Chota to warn the Watauga area, causing the death of many Cherokees. Soon after, she obtained the reputation of being a friend of the settlers. In 1776, Colonel William Christian led 2,000 troops in a horrific raid against the Cherokee towns. Out of respect to Nancy Ward, Chota was spared. In 1780, the Cherokees again prepared an attack on the Watauga settlements while the men were away. Nancy Ward again warned the whites, but when the soldiers returned from King's Mountain and learned of the threat, they set out to teach the Cherokees a lesson they would never forget. Despite the pleas of Nancy Ward for mercy and friendship, Chota was destroyed, along with several other Cherokee towns. Afterwards, she and her family were placed into protective custody. Once Nancy was released, she returned to help rebuild Chota. On July 20, 1781, she was the featured speaker for the Cherokees that brought about a peace treaty between the Watagas. She continued her mission to make dramatic pleas for peace between the Indians and the whites. After the war years ended, Nancy Ward settled in Chota, which was no longer the capital of the nation, but was still a city of refuge. For years, she took orphans into her home. Nancy died in 1822 as a woman of honor among the Cherokee and white history. From 1794 to 1836, the Cherokees fled to hill country to build a thriving community that was run by mixed bloods. Change after change kept coming to the tribe as a whole that eventually shook their traditional faith and beliefs. In confusion and doubt, the Cherokees became more open and responsive to the missionary efforts of the Moravian, Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, and Quaker churches. During the next 30 years, the Cherokee Nation underwent many changes and moved their tribe closer to the whites to become more a part of their civilization. They began to learn the ways of the white men. The Cherokees wanted to learn to read and write, and the Fullbloods did not welcome the change and considered it bad. The Presbyterian Church established a mission in Hiawassee, Tennessee in 1803. Their school opened in 1804 with 20 to 30 Cherokees in attendance. The students learned the Bible and how to pray, how to read, spell, and write. Due to the cultural differences and the fact the students could speak no English, the first conversion did not take place until 1810. Domestic and religious changes, intermarriage, loss of confidence, whiskey, contributions of the mixed blood, and the mission schools all took their toll on the Cherokees. They began to wear the white men's clothes and adapt to their lifestyle. The Cherokees had their own cabins and other amenities just like the white settlers. The Green Corn Festival had now become corrupted with guns and whiskey. The priests became known as conjurers, which caused this once great ancient religion to struggle and waver in what they once believed. John Howard Payne believed the changes were caused by the influx of pagan worshippers. It was a sure sign that these were a people in exodus because of the ways of foreigners, both Native American and European. Sickness and tormenting evil spirits now haunted the Indians. The new conjurers were unsuccessful in helping the people spiritually. What once were sacred holy festivals were now tainted with new customs and beliefs of many religions and pagan beliefs. Before 1750, the Cherokees had a core group of families from which came the Cherokee leaders. These families would also supply the ministers or priests of the Cherokee religion. This system is found in Semitic tribes and some other Native American tribes, Caddo, for example. The thinking or reasoning was that the youths of these families were trained from an early age because the amount of training was considerable by any standards of modern professions. Leading families were responsible for training leaders. But as the old religion slipped away, and these families acted in irresponsible, oppressive, and self-serving ways, things fell apart. The last trained uku to come from a leading family tradition surrendered his position, and it never existed again. However, these truths live on, smoldering, perhaps someday to flame again. Somewhere in time, these Cherokee Native Americans integrated with, or were themselves originally, a people in exodus. Either way, each group became the other. All Cherokees are their descendants. The storytellers have for centuries been the ones to continue the remembering and the telling of instructions, as valid today as when Nunez-Lenahi, the provider, gave them to us. Whether they told the victory stories of Aniyoski, the warriors, during the honoring ceremonies, the healing stories of Didanawiski, the medicine men and women to cure sickness, the teaching stories told to Usti Diniyothli, the little ones, as they snuggled beneath their blankets on cold winter nights in front of a warm fire. Or those other stories told just for fun, after Ústí-Dinihóatlí were sound asleep. These stories spoke of who we were and who we were trying to be, and they still teach us. In the words of Joseph Bruchak Abenaki, we human beings are not just mind and body. We are also spirit and emotion. There are few things that speak as clearly as stories speak to the needed balance between all four of those components that make up human life: the body, mind, spirit, and emotion. Stories have great power. That is why you can tell a story to five people, and five people will hear five different messages. Stories also have the power to destroy. If told wrongly, if told with evil intent, stories can confuse the minds and the spirits of those who hear them. They can lead the listener away from harmony and balance and into the twisting paths of hate and anger. We've all heard such stories. Stories in which those from other cultures are portrayed as evil and dangerous. Stories used to convince people that those others are less than human and must be eliminated. Millions of people have died and are still dying because of such stories. Ethnic caricatures are further examples of the way certain stories can be used to debase and lessen the humanity of others. In a real sense, stories can be used to kill both the spirit and the body. But through the stories, we can also survive. We can do so at the expense of others, or we can survive as fully human in the Indian sense, the Cherokee sense. In other words, we need to be aware of the earth below, the sky above, aware of all the beauty around us, and the necessity of walking in balance everywhere we go. This awareness is the message the stories bring to us, a connection between Mother Earth and Father Sky, the bridge over which we can travel to the world of once was, to the world of what could be. This is the conscious choice I make as a Cherokee storyteller. I believe that in those old stories can be found the guidestones that point the way for us in a very dangerous world, not only in regards to Mother Earth and how we treat her, but in our relationships with each other, our community, and our world. There is a story among the Cherokee that once, a long time ago, all the people lived together. But as people do, they began to quarrel. So Hunaitlanahi decided to separate them and sent people to the east, north, west, and south. And the new places changed them to the four colors of people we see today: white, black, red, and yellow. And because these places were new to the people, Hunaitlanahi sent instructions in dreams as legends and stories to guide them. It is said that the world today is the way it is because the people have forgotten their instructions. Come, listen to what the Cherokee people were told. Nogoja.
Hola.
Osta. Hiyaki dudu. Akino hei klani. This is what my grandfather told me. This story, katoha, tlameha usani kanohili. Why, bat flies at night. Iti, a long time ago, all of the bird people were talking one day. Awohali the eagle said, "You know, there are so many birds, so many bird people in our tribe. I don't know everyone." Tawodi the hawk and Kolana the raven said, "Yeah, that is true. There are so many birds, I don't know all of them either." Awohali said, "Let us have a feast and bring all of the bird people together. Then we will get to know each other." So the word went out all through the forest, and the bird people started coming. Achiskoko Robin, he was the first to come. He was the firekeeper, and he started building the fire. But he got too close to the fire, that's why he wears a red chest today. And so all of the animals came, and they had a marvelous feast. They played games and had a wonderful time. But while they were there, Glamiha, the little bat, came up and said, "Why wasn't I invited? I am a bird. See, I have wings. I can fly. I am a bird. Why did you not invite me to your feast?" And the bird people looked around and said, "Well, I don't know. Come and join us." And so Glamiha joined the bird people and had a feast, and they played games, and Glamiha even sang and danced. It was a marvelous time. Well, later on, a few days later, the animal people heard about the bird people's feast. And the animal people said, "You know, that is a pretty good idea." Yansa Buffalo, he said, "That was a good idea. I think we should do the same thing, because there are so many animals in the forest. I don't know them all. This would give us a chance to get together and meet them." And so, Wahya the wolf, Jistu rabbit, they went out to tell everyone, and everybody came. One of the first to come was Toya. Toya was beaver, and he brought his wood chips, and he fanned the fire with his flat tail and made a nice fire for all of the animals. And they, too, played games and were having a marvelous time getting to know each other. But here came Glamiha, the little gray bat, and he said, "Why wasn't I invited to the animals' feast? I am an animal. See, I have fur. I have little ears. And see my teeth? I am an animal." And the animal people said, "Well, yes, you are. Come and join us." So Glamiha joined the animals in their feast, too. They all had a big time. Sikwa, pig, even sang and danced, and that was pretty funny to see. Well, later on, Jistu and Chikoko, Robin and Rabbit, were talking. And Jistu said to Chikoko, "Well, how was your feast?" And Chikoko said, "We had a marvelous time. Everybody came." And she started listing all of the bird people who had come. Suli Buzzard was there, Kolana, Avohale, Tawori, the hawk, even Glamiha. And Jistu said, "Glamiha?" Chikoko said, "Yeah, Glamiha came to our feast." And then Chikoko said, "Why do you ask?" And Jistu said, "Because Glamiha came to our feast too. He said he was an animal." And so then they went to see the councils. It didn't take long for the council people to get together and say, "We need to talk to Glamiha about this, because he can't be both animal and bird." So the joint council called Glamiha before them. And Avohale, the head of the bird people, said, "Glamiha, since you lied to us and told us you were a bird, then you went and ate with the animal people, you can no longer be a member of the bird people." And Yansa, the buffalo, he said to Glamiha, "Since you told us that you were an animal, then you go and eat with the bird people. You cannot be with the animal people anymore. You are outcast." And so that's why Glamiha, he must hunt always at night, all by himself, when everyone else is asleep, because he lied, and he tried to be two things at the same time. Niga.
Imagine, if you will, what it was like on that warm spring morning in 1842 in Park Hill, Indian Territory. It had rained the night before, and the air was heavy and moist. The sky was clearing and showed the promise of a good day, but the heaviness in the air weighed on Sequoia in several ways. One, he hadn't been able to get rid of the persistent cough, and two, he was tired of the seemingly constant arguing among the people. Ever since John Ross and the Treaty Party had arrived, there had been bickering over who would be the principal power of the Cherokee, the old settlers or the treaty party. It had only been through the efforts of Reverend Bushyhead and Sequoia that the Act of Union was ever adopted. The one agreement was on the name of the new government, the Cherokee Nation. It would have been nice if that had settled it, but it hadn't. There were still arguments on every level whenever two or more Cherokees got together. Sequoia was tired of it and wanted a rest. He decided to travel to Mexico, something he had intended to do for some time. He and his wife Sally had found some Mexican pottery shards with what looked like Cherokee designs on them. They were most curious. Where had they come from, and how long had they been here? Maybe in Mexico he could find the source of the Cherokee knowledge, the Mexican Indians who perhaps had taught the Cherokee secrets, secrets still kept hidden from the white men. If he could find that tribe whose name he didn't know, he might find the Indian language that was the root of all Indian languages. Maybe there had been an ancient written Cherokee language that had been lost when the Anticutani were overthrown. Maybe there in Mexico, with all of the other lost and forgotten pieces of Indian knowledge, were the answers. Maybe even he could possibly find the end of his life's work. And then there were the stories of the lost Cherokees. After the assault on their village in East Texas in July of 1839, many Cherokees had fled south to Mexico and were now living there. Yes, now would be a good time as any, but he had to be careful. It could be very dangerous in Texas. It wasn't that long ago that there had been many accusations about the relationship between the Texas Cherokees and the Mexicans. And there were still many people in Texas who thought the Cherokees were not to be trusted. However, the only way to Mexico was through Texas. And it was quite possible, right now, that his trip would be misunderstood. So if he did go, it would have to be for a valid reason, perhaps just to visit the Cherokees who lived there. Besides, trouble and fighting was what he was anxious to get away from, not run into. So that became the story. He was going to Mexico to visit with the Cherokees who lived there. Sally was a little reluctant at first, but had learned early on that when Sequoia had made up his mind, there was little that she could do to dissuade him. So she finally agreed. Perhaps the trip would do him good. T.C., his son, protested the idea at first as well, but finally agreed with his mother not to let his father undertake the long journey alone, especially now. Besides, it looked as though this could be really an adventure, and he had three friends who would readily agree to an adventure. Sequoia wanted at least four men in the party, and was pleased when the number increased to six. He visited with his good friend, the Worm, Ayujia, and shared with him his planned trip, swearing him and the other members of the party to secrecy. The fewer who knew of his mission, the better. They spent a few days at the home of Archibald Campbell, and purchased supplies and equipment from Lewis Ross. Finally, on a bright sunny day in late April, Sequoia on his white mule, his son T.C., Ayujia, the Worm, Uwasote, Kataha, Nuwatana, Taladu, Cricket, and the youngest, a boy named Koteska, all on horseback, left Park Hill for Texas and Mexico. They crossed the Arkansas River near Fort Gibson, passed near Edward's settlement on Little River, and followed the road laid out by Lieutenant Leavenworth to near Council Springs, the future site of Oklahoma City. The weather continued warm and pleasant for this time of year, but they knew it would soon become hot and dusty as they made their way across Mondawi, Texas, the place of the sun. For now, though, the wind continued soft and warm as they turned and headed south toward the Red River. They arrived there 15 days later. Sequoia noted they were in good hunting country, so they camped just north of the Red River where there was good water. The journey was taking its toll on him, though. He was bothered with a cough and pains in his chest. This would be a good place to rest a while. In the meantime, Sequoia sent Ayujia and two others to visit among the Indian villages to the west to see if there had been any Cherokees there. For the next week, Ayujia and his two companions traveled among the Wichitas, the principal inhabitants, and also among the Waco, Caddo, Echasi, and others who were living in the neighboring villages but speaking different languages. They found no Cherokee, but did learn that there were some living along the Washita River. When they returned, they found Sequoia very sick. TC had offered him honey and venison, but Sequoia was unable to eat any of it and asked if they could find him some bread instead. Sequoia liked honey, and it would have given him energy, but for some reason its taste was gone. Ayujia did manage to find some wild plums, which Sequoia enjoyed and said made him feel much better. And although sick, Sequoia continued writing in his journal. Ayujia decided to travel back to the Wichita village, some 4 days distant, to see if he could purchase some corn. Then they would be able to make some bread for Sequoia. In the meantime, the rest of the group would slowly continue on. After arriving at the Wichita village a second time, Ayujia purchased 3 bushels of corn, packed it on their horses, and immediately started back. On the evening of the third day, Ayujia's horse grew lame, but they were able to catch up with Sequoia and the others near a clear, babbling brook. There was good water and hunting here, and Sequoia was anxious for some hot bread. So they quickly prepared a fire, and the food was made ready. After eating, Sequoia said he felt much better, asked for a pipe and some tobacco, and then laid down. They rested there another day, and then hurried on to the next village, where they hoped to be able to buy some horses. Sequoia didn't want to remain among the Wichitas, but rather wanted to return to the timbered country along their proposed route where they could hunt. After nearly a 3-day ride, they arrived at the village of the Echasi people, where they were accepted as friends. Clouds had rolled in, and it smelled of rain. Their senses weren't wrong, and that evening, the summer rain rolled in just before dark. They spent the next day in the village talking with the elders, who made them presents of tobacco and other small articles. It was then that Sequoia decided it would be best for the young men to return home so they wouldn't also become sick, and that he, Ayujia, and Tisi would continue on alone. Sequoia's chest was sore and tender from the coughing, and he was weakened by fighting the pain. He knew he would need frequent stops to recuperate, which would make the journey longer for them. So the 6 young men returned to Park Hill. The next morning, the 3 remaining men, Ayujia, Sequoia, and Tisi, resumed their journey to Mexico. A week later, they came upon a clear-flowing river, where they again rested for several days while they searched for honey and hunted. It also gave them a chance to bathe and clean up. The way had been easy so far, relaxing almost, with only an occasional rain shower which did little more than just get them wet. Often, of an evening, they would go to sleep under their de cloyoda, their tents, listening to Ayatokoloski thunder, and watching the fire streaks of Anigaliski lightning stab across the night sky. This was the rainy season, and to be expected. It was on such a night 5 days later that they heard gunshots. The next day, they overtook a band of Shawnees who had been hunting in the area. Later that night, they all camped together. The Shawnees were curious about where they were headed. Sequoia told them he felt a great desire to visit the country of the Mexicans, but that soon he would return. He then asked the direction to the nearest Mexican town or village, and they indicated the same direction Ayugia had been leading them. 5 days later, he again asked Ayugia to be sure and help him get to Mexico, where he felt certain he had to be. Sequoia's chest pains had become more constant now, and he began to wonder if he would ever see Sally or his salt works again. Their journey south took them across a large river, and after crossing a mountain, they came to another beautiful stream where the company halted. They again went hunting for honey, which the presence of Wadulisi, honeybees, indicated was nearby. When they awoke on their third morning there, they found that some Tawakani Indians had stolen their horses. TC and the worm quickly gave chase and could probably have overtaken them, but were reluctant to leave Sequoia alone in his condition, so they quickly returned to camp. The next morning, Sequoia asked them to take him to a safe hiding place and then to proceed quickly and directly to the Mexican settlements, hopefully to obtain some horses. After traveling several days on foot, TC and Ayugia came to a large river they called Mauluke. They couldn't find a crossing, so they camped that night, planning to build a raft the next day, cross the river, and hurry on to San Antonio. They soon arrived, and hearing only Spanish being spoken, entered the town and attempted to find some horses, but were met by two Mexican soldiers. The soldiers were friendly enough, but asked them to follow them to their commanding officer. The commander asked them what tribe they belonged to, and when Ayugia told him Cherokee, the commander told him he didn't like Cherokee and asked for their passports. Ayugia quickly told them they had none and weren't aware they needed any. He also told the commander that Tawakani Indians had stolen their horses, and all they wanted was some horses so they could continue their journey. After a while, the commander became a little more friendly, telling him that it was true. Wild Indians had been prowling around stealing horses, and that they needed to be careful. He then added they had no extra horses for them. Finally, the commander gave them their papers, some tobacco, and a very good axe, and again the warning to be on guard, as there were many hostile persons among the wild tribes, especially the Apaches. A day later, they arrived back at Sequoia's camp, and was pleased to find him feeling better after his rest. Ayugia decided to find an even better hiding place for Sequoia, while he and TC continued on to the Mexican villages. They located a cave in a bluff high above the stream below and made Sequoia as comfortable as they could, leaving him with a good supply of honey and venison sufficient to last him 20 days. On their third day since leaving Sequoia, Ayugia and TC were surprised to see several Comanches running quickly toward them. Taking cover behind some bushes, Ayugia hailed them and asked them in Comanche if they were friends. They said they were, and immediately relaxed their lances and bows. The Comanches told them they had at first thought them to be Texans because of the caps they were wearing, and would have fired on them if they hadn't seen their feathers. They told Ayugia and Tisi of the shortest and safest route to the Mexican villages, and agreed to go part of the distance with them. Ayugia, Tisi, and the Comanches traveled together for about 3 days, and then parted, each going their own way. 14 days later, Ayugia and TC reached the Rio Grande, although at that time they didn't know its name. They hailed a horseman on the opposite bank, a Mexican, and they were informed that there was a ferry lower down, and they could cross there. After crossing, they were met by a company of Mexican soldiers who escorted them to the leader of a town some 6 miles distant. The village was small, the houses made of large bricks and mortar. The houses were low, with flat roofs, and looked quite old. After locating an interpreter, they learned that these Mexicans had been part of a group of soldiers that had defeated the Texans in battle, and taken some 300 prisoners, a fact they were quite proud of. Once satisfied that Ayugia and Tisi were not in his town on any public business, the officer expressed the pleasure it gave him to see them, and invited Ayugia and Tisi to spend the night in town. The next day was spent enjoying the hospitality of the village. That evening they visited the house of their interpreter again, and to their surprise met a Cherokee man by the name of Anunya Chitoga, Standing Rock. The following morning they were shown directions to the small town of San Fernando, some 30 miles further south. 3 miles further on, they arrived at the Cherokee village, situated within a grove of timber half a mile wide and some 3 miles long, watered by means of a ditch filled with flowing water from a large spring some 2 miles distant. Ayugia and Tisi told them that Sequoia was in their company and waiting for them just north of San Antonio. The Mexican Cherokees were excited to meet the great Sequoia and gave Ayugia a horse they borrowed from a man in San Fernando and food for their journey. Ayugia and Tisi quickly returned to where they had left Sequoia and guided him to Mexico and the welcoming Cherokees. Our journey in 2001 to San Fernando, now known as Zaragoza, was much different. But our desire to get there was just as real. For 2 years previous, Dr. Charles Rogers had been searching the Mexican countryside, asking people the simple question, what do you know of the Cherokee? A Cherokee descendant himself, Dr. Rogers had taken it upon himself to find the lost village of the Cherokee and the elusive grave of Sequoia. From the Mexican elders came the stories of how the Cherokees had come to their village, where they had built their village, and the photographs and stories of their Cherokee ancestors, the names of their grandfathers and grandmothers, Cherokee names, names that had been held secret for almost 160 years. These were the descendants of the Cherokees who fled Texas in July of 1839. The lost Cherokee village site and Sequoia's grave had been found. The story unfolded when the Rogers family met with the Rodriguez family, on whose land, it turned out, a cave was located. The Rodriguez family was skeptical. Since the early 1900s, many Cherokees had come to this spot, searching for the grave. But the family had always turned them away, unsure of their motives, keeping the site secret. None had come with their families. None had come in traditional clothing, as the Mexican families knew good Cherokees would have done, out of respect. And none came with what they felt was a good heart. The secret of the gravesite was one that Gloria and her family and Epigmenio and his family had separately kept for many years. Several generations before, the families had disputed over some land that ended in a feud that resulted in years of silence between them. Then one day, young Gloria and Epigmenio went away to college, where they met, began to date, and fell in love. When they discovered that their families had been silently warring with each other for years, they eloped. Both families were initially outraged, but soon learned to accept and love the couple. Early in their marriage, Gloria and Epigmenio, while sharing family secrets, discovered that both families shared many of the same family stories, stories about the Cherokee and Sequoia. And so, when they met the Rogers family, they were naturally suspicious, but curious. And when they saw them emerge from their car, Gloria gasped and whispered to Epigmenio, reminding him of the dream she had told him about just a few days earlier. A dream about a man who looked just like Dr. Rogers. Then the two families sat down for breakfast and began talking. Gloria and Epigmenio were taken with young Charles and Grandmother Mary, Dr. Rogers' mother, and they were heartened to see that the Rogers family were wearing traditional Cherokee clothing. Gloria was also pleased to see a deep sense of family among them. Encouraged, Gloria and Epic Menu decided it was time to see if the stories were true, and without letting on, invited the Rogers family to come and visit a special place, a cave not too far distant. They led Charles and his family, Sharon his wife, young Charles their son, and his mother Mary, to a cave located in a depression in the high Sonoran desert. The air was charged with anticipation about where they were going. One by one, they entered the inconspicuous opening that led to the first of several small underground rooms, its first visitors in generations. The local people had been told that the cave was inhabited by spirits, and they might not like any intrusion, so the site was protected by the stories. Young Charles, Sololi, which means squirrel in Cherokee, was very eager to enter, as was 86-year-old matriarch Mary, also known as Walela, which means hummingbird, and because of her stiff leg, had to be dragged into the cave while seated on her jacket. Inside, everyone spoke in hushed tones about the past as young Charles explored the cave. After 30 minutes, young Charles pointed to a mark, obviously carved into the wall, a mark so obvious that it should have been seen at once, but it wasn't. Young Charles asked, "Dad, what's that?" As they turned to look at the mark, Gloria said, "Of course he would find it, just like the prophecy told." Dr. Rogers asked, "What prophecy?" Then Gloria related the story, what Sequoia had told her ancestors, not to reveal the burial site to anyone, and that one day a child would come and find it and carry forth his spirit message of brotherhood and unity to all Cherokee. Shortly after this, young Charles was given the new Cherokee name of Adilahoski, prophet. The sense that destiny had had a hand in this search was underscored several years later when the Rogers family was out sightseeing in Brackettville, Texas. While driving past a small frame house, they glimpsed the word Chisqua, Cherokee for bird, written above the door. The sign in the yard said, "Native American Museum." They stopped, backed up, and found no one at home. They asked around the neighborhood until they finally located the owner, a diminutive but dynamic lady named Nakai Breen. Nakai invited them into her home, the museum, and shared with them her fascinating story. Orphaned by her Cherokee parents, Nakai was raised by a Kiowa family. At the age of 12, she in turn adopted an elderly Kickapoo man and woman who were homeless at the time and begged her mother to shelter them. The couple had been living hand to mouth under the bridge between Mexico and Texas. Nakai grew to love the Kickapoo. As a young woman, she single-handedly took the tribe to Washington and eloquently pleaded their case. In a moving speech, she declared that every human being had a right to a spot on the face of the earth, touching the hearts of what had been hardened politicians. The Kickapoos were granted their own land. After hearing Nakai's story, Dr. Rogers told their story in turn. At its end, Nakai said that she had many things to think about and gave her blessings to young Charles, Adilahoski. When next they met, Nakai said that she had prayed and decided to tell them of events in her distant past. As a young girl, an elder had told her that the Cherokee would one day be sent four white buffalo. One would be in the form of a child. This child would have as his purpose to unite the Cherokee in brotherhood, and it would be Nakai's task to teach the child things he would need to know. She then began to tell young Charles many stories of her childhood and to recount many stories that had been passed down from the Cherokees for generations. Young Charles, Adilahoski, feels very blessed to have been guided to this special Cherokee elder. Shortly after Dr. Rogers called and told me of this discovery, Larry, my wife, and I went to Eagle Pass, Texas, where we met Dr. Rogers and the other Cherokees who had come to make the pilgrimage. We drove down on a Friday, covering in 45 minutes what would have taken Sequoia a full day or longer in 1842. Al and Frankie Heron of Tahlequah had flown to San Antonio, and we had agreed to pick them up and carry them the rest of the way to Eagle Pass. It was the middle of March, and the fields south of San Antonio were filled with bluebonnets. After breakfast at the hotel, we climbed aboard two buses and crossed the International Bridge into Mexico, traveling southwest to Morelos and then northwest to Zaragoza. The high desert air of Coahuila was hazy and chilly. The sun didn't show itself that day, and the clouds that gathered added to the expectant yet somber feeling that everyone was feeling. There was, of course, excitement. Everyone was excited. But there was also a quietness, as though words weren't necessary to express their feelings. The normal chatter of people traveling somewhere together was subdued and almost whispered. When the buses rolled through the towns, they seemed out of place on the narrow streets, among the small concrete brick-and-mortar houses similar to the ones Sequoia saw when he walked the same streets. Once through Zaragoza, the paved streets became dirt paths lined with mesquite trees that scraped along the sides of the buses as we passed. Before long, the buses stopped, and we had to walk the rest of the way. The road had disappeared. We crossed a sulfur-scented creek and soon came to the rubble of what had once been a hacienda, the Hacienda Patinos, near the Cherokee village. The creek was formed by a large artesian well that roared from the earth in an enormous 18-inch-wide stream. The temperature of the water was 98.6, which made going to water much more enjoyable for the Cherokee. We also discovered that the sulfur odor wasn't in the water, but actually rode above it and quickly dissipated. This was where the Cherokees sought safety from the Texans. This is where the Mexican people welcomed them with open arms. They understood. We all gathered and stood in the gray, chilly afternoon under a threatening, misty sky and listened to Gloria Rodriguez and her grandfather relate to us the stories about the Cherokees, and most importantly, where Sequoia was buried. For almost 160 years, the secret had been kept by the people, protecting the gravesite until the parameters of a legend had been met and the site could be properly honored. We were led to an area about a mile away. In what direction, I'm not sure, since the desert looks the same in all directions. The valley was flat, and what appeared to be an area covered with rock not 30 yards away turned out to be a depression with two small caves opposite each other. The larger of the two was where the story said Sequoia was buried. No one spoke as the people encircled the entrance to the cave. Dr. Rogers carefully weighed the stick inside the entrance with a small piece of red cloth attached. This was to arouse any snakes that might happen to be in the cave. Dr. Rogers then asked me to call out to Ujonate Rattlesnake, saying in Cherokee, "We are Cherokee and have come to honor Sequoia." No snake emerged or made any sound. So two at a time, people crawled through the small entrance to the cave. When it was my turn, I crawled in and sat in the first chamber. In the dim light, I could see a mounded hump on the cave floor in the adjoining chamber, a hump composed of dirt not of the cave floor. The cave floor was covered with rock shards and chips that had fallen from the ceiling. This mound was composed of soil, leaves, and twigs. Imagine, if you will, sitting inside this cave, this tomb of Sequoia, the man who had given the Cherokee a way to remember, a way to write and preserve their language. As I sat there dressed in a ribbon shirt, leggings, and feathered turban, I thought of the stories I had read and what I had heard about Sequoia. True, I had been to Tennessee and visited the memorial for him near the place of his birth, which is now under the waters of the TVA Dam Project, but this was different. He was here, less than 15 feet from where I sat. My thoughts were disturbed when a large rattlesnake was noticed stretched out on a ledge not 3 feet from my head. I felt a little fear, and fortunately the snake never moved. Was it because the air outside was slightly chilly? The air inside the cave was not. In fact, it was almost warm. Was it a spirit snake? Some said it was a guardian of the gravesite. I don't know why the snake never moved or threatened us in any way, but it didn't. I just know what happened, or in this case, didn't happen. I can still see the snake lying there and the mounded earth in the second chamber, even though the cave has since been sealed to protect it. The area surrounding the gravesite and encompassing a few acres has since been purchased and designated by the Mexican government as the Nación Cherokee de México. This is where we hope to reconstitute the Cherokee Nation as it used to be, according to the stories, and to fulfill Sequoia's wish. According to what has been told to us by the stories, he wanted to stay in Mexico, where the Cherokee were welcomed and befriended. If anyone would understand, Sally would, and Tisi would have explained that Sequoia wouldn't have survived the trip back anyway. Besides, Indian territory wasn't his home. His home was where he had been born, in Tuskegee. Indian territory, where the Cherokee Nation is now located in Oklahoma, was where the American government had forced them to go, and where the government wanted to keep them. In 1836, the U.S. Secretary of War refused to allow Chief John Ross permission to sell the Cherokee lands and move the entire tribe to Mexico. Much later, in 1895, the Western Cherokees would again consider a vote to move to Mexico. And again, it was denied. When the anti-Indian Texas government heard of Sequoia's arrival in Mexico, they immediately sent the army to covertly and illegally enter the country and arrest him and the other Cherokees who had fled Texas. Without due process of law and under threat of force, they arrested Sequoia, who even at 73 years of age and suffering from a severe lung infection, managed to suddenly disappear, escaping his captors while crossing the Rio Grande River at night. Sequoia, fighting collapse, persevered and returned to Zaragoza, where the kind-hearted Mexican people and the Patiño Rodriguez Salinas families of a nearby hacienda bravely and without consideration for their own personal safety hid him in a secret cave. Sequoia, who had been ill for some time, became exhausted from this struggle and flight from captivity. It was here, in this now crumbled hacienda, that the great Sequoia died peacefully, a free person, among some of his Cherokee family and many Mexican friends. It was here, in this cave, that he was buried. In the hacienda on his deathbed, he told of a Cherokee child that would come someday, find his grave, and bring his spirit of brotherhood back to the Cherokee and all other people of good heart. That is what we are doing. That is why we are here. That is the invitation we offer you. It is not a question of who we are trying to become. It is a question of becoming who we are. On the first weekend of each February, the little town of Zaragoza celebrates its founding. The Cherokees are now part of that celebration, honoring the return of the Cherokees to Zaragoza. Actually, the descendants of the Cherokees who escaped the Texas Army are still there, and upon our visit over the past 3 years, they have made themselves known to us. In one sense of the word, they are Ocharadiknai, our family. Dr. Charles Rogers and his family were out driving one weekend and happened to find themselves in the little South Texas town of Brackettville. As they drove through town, they noticed in the front yard of a small house a sign that read, American Indian Museum. Over the doorway was written, Chisqua, the Cherokee word for bird. Knowing that accidents rarely happen, that things occur because they are supposed to occur, they stopped and located the owner. Her name is Nakai Breen, born a Cherokee in Oklahoma. At the time of her birth, the Cherokee people were still recovering from the effects of the Dawes Allotment Program that had devastated them, destroyed their lives, and left many homeless. Her family wasn't able to care for her. As is the Indian way, Nakai was taken in and raised by friends. In this case, a Kiowa family that lived not far from 14 Mile Creek near Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Later, at age 7, the family moved to Texas, where she was raised and later married, and became an honored elder, healer, and storyteller. In the never-ending quest for the truth and direction, Dr. Rogers and his family, wife Sharon and young Charles Jr., visited with Nakai the rest of that afternoon, and in doing so, met their future. As was his practice, Dr. Rogers videotaped the meeting to ensure nothing would be lost during the conversation, and its source could always be proven. This was how all of the old stories were gathered from the Mexican elders when asked, "What do you know of the Cherokee?" Once recorded from the source, one could not question from where it came. And so it was on this warm afternoon, sitting among the Indian artifacts and Cherokee Kiowa memorabilia, that this story was told. Nakai began by saying that she was hesitant to speak of what she had to say because she didn't know them and didn't know how it would be heard. Encouraged that she was among friends and that they meant her no harm, Nakai nodded, rocked back in her chair, and closed her eyes. After a moment of silence, she told this story. When she was 13 years old, an elder told her he had a vision and that there was something he must say to her. Here she paused and said that a vision occurs early in the morning, and you know it's a vision and not a dream when you feel as though you were there in that place, feeling those feelings and seeing all around you. The elder then told her of his vision. He said there will come a time, maybe while you are still young, maybe while you are middle age, maybe even when you're a grandmother, that you will get to see what I am about to tell you. You will see this because it has been in your surroundings since way back, way before you were born. There will come a time when there will be 4 white buffalo come to the Indian people. Now, the white buffalo does not belong to the Cherokee, Nakai cautioned. The white buffalo belongs to the Plains people, and each of the Plains tribes will get their own white buffalo. The Cherokee will get their white buffalo in the form of a child. She said, you will know this child by the name he carries. Not his given name, but a name given to him later on. Sololi, the Cherokee name for squirrel. Sololi will come searching for something that was lost, and he will find it. It will take time for him to actually find what he is looking for, but he will find it. Sololi, the squirrel, during the Trail of Tears, was the only one they could hunt for using their blowguns. Sololi fed them, nourished them. They made moccasins out of the fur. They made gloves, and the fat from that was put on the babies to keep them warm. Sololi is a very powerful name. This Sololi will always be scampering here and there, she said, because he is searching for food and for an elder. He will even cross the big water searching, but he won't find what he's looking for until he comes back over the big water. Then Nakai, said the elder, looked into her eyes and said, Nakai, you will get to know this child. As she said this, she turned in her chair and nodded smilingly at young Charles sitting on her right. Because, she went on, you are Adelohoski, the prophet. That is your name now, Adelohoski. You are the white buffalo of our people, and you have been given this title, but even your own people, your own relatives, will never believe you. A lot of people will say, you are nothing, you are a nobody. Other people will push you around, discriminate against you, but you have been chosen for a great responsibility. You might think your parents told you this, but they didn't. It was written a long way back before you were even born. I was told that in time, the elders would come and honor you by their presence. You will be held back, but you must keep pushing on and on. Like other people in other times, messengers of peace have been ridiculed and doubted. This is what was told to me.
The time is now when the Indian will triumph.
He's still in the rapture of the vision. A great Indian holy man, Malvoka, is speaking through him.
You mean they had holy men like saints?
They sure did, and Malvoka was one of the greatest. Once even Christ appeared to him.
And the whole spiritual wisdom of the great holy men of the Indian tradition is now what the young people of the world are looking for.
I wonder if I have the guts.
This is crazy, man. You pull that trigger and we'll never get out of here alive.
The young whites, they know there is a supernatural world and a great spirit, and they try to reach the great spirit. They try by drugs. They are made to do this because their religions no longer believe in the other world. Heaven is not out there. The other world is here. The great spirit, Messiah, the Christ, are here in this pit. Your people, my loved ones, there is a thin veil separating us from them. The whites do not know how to reach through that veil. They do not have the belief, and they cannot touch their loved ones or the other spirits.
I could do it. I could kill them.
Yeah, sure you can, but not now, man. Let's get out of here and get some help.
And lastly, you must learn the dance. The dance of friendship and welcome, in which all whites who come to you with open hearts must be taught the dance in the Indian way. Rise up now, and I will teach you the dance exactly as Wovoka has seen it should be done.
Yeah, we'll be back, but not with help. I'm going to get him all by myself.
Thought you guys might like that. And I just want to add, Andy Vidovich, who was Wovoka's grandson, was on the cast and crew of that movie, and they actually had a helicopter take off and show exactly how to do the ghost dance.
Right.
And, thought you guys would like that.
I have one last question for the good doctor.
Go ahead.
Okay, when you're in the depths of the rainforest, and I experienced this down in Dominica, and they have one that's virtually untouched because it's on the Kalinago land, and they themselves don't go in there unless some of their elders do and some of the old people do, but basically they leave it alone. I think it's out of partial fear and partial respect. But when I'm in there, I everything that I see that's apparent, always figure that that's a gift because it's apparent, and I can't help but to look at uncountable chemical compounds extending 100 feet above me and miles out on each side, and I know full well it's like looking at the heavens and how many Earths are there out there. You don't have to be a genius to figure out mathematically that the place is crawling with undiscovered what we know. And so your work, the way I see it, you're part of the vanguard at keeping this thing alive and having a modern practical use for it, so that it takes its place in the world of medicine. And it will do eventually, of course, transition over to this side. But behind your work, probably long after you and I are both gone, you're going to have opened up things. I mean, they all talk about, well, let's go to the rainforest and look at this, but the cartels on all the big money diseases is going to be negligent to drag in a true champion, a true winner. It's going to come from somewhere outside the system. How do you handle knowing that it's all around you, and you're doing is wonderful with what is apparent and available, documented, and I dare say after speaking to you tonight, you've made some discoveries of your own. I would almost bet money on that. So after us, isn't it going to be a better world?
Well, I believe and I trust that people like yourself, like Flaming Eagle and Blue Otter and many others, we have to come together and we have to find a way how to preserve this knowledge. We have to integrate the ancient and the new. Integration is more the sum of two. Is the third thing which happens. And it's very difficult for me many times because I'm only one person. But whenever I see a patient and I see the patient has his clinical condition and his it's been better, and in many cases, patient gets cured. That very cure for me is a constant inspiration and motivation to carry on. And yes, I have discovered many things, and for many of these things I have discovered, and is still much to discover. I could have been killed if I did not deal with the matter in a very tactful and diplomatic way, because you see there is so much still there. I mean, there are things which I really would like to do, but I need to have a help, and I think there is a possibility. Are you yourself, you're based in Mexico, or where are you based?
No, I'm licensed in Mexico and the Commonwealth of Dominica.
Right. The thing is, I definitely would like to meet you.
Absolutely, Doctor.
Or you come to me.
His health, the threats, the National Cancer
because
Institute.
Because I have some most amazing anti-cancerous plants you can think of, because Amazon is the most sophisticated biodiversity in evolution of the plants, is the most sophisticated one, and I wish to have a different instrument to be able to check all these things, because nobody is really truly studying it, you see. So we definitely need to connect, and then when we connect,
well, we're connected, and we'll follow through.
And I am definitely smiling from ear to ear, guys.
And I totally, entirely, from the very bottom of my heart, Walter, I wholeheartedly congratulate you and thank you for the kindness.
Thank you, Blue Otter.
The opportunity for me to be there and to share all this with you good people.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, well, being a Scotchman, I'm counting on they're frugal with their information. They even save the smoke off of their candles.
Well,
I'm definitely going to share with you all I know. Once you interpret that through a Scotsman, that means that there's a massive amount.
I'm lucky that I'm only partially Scotsman, because I have a Tibetan and Indian and Scandinavian blood as well.
Hey, Dr. Drew, what's your blood type?
Whales.
What's your blood type, Dr. Drew?
Okay.
Mine is B negative. I understand B. You said Tibetan, and that just perked my ears up, because I understand that the B
blood type originated on the Tibetan plateau. I'm a fan of Dr. Dynamo, who wrote Eat Right for Your Type. Well, it's
What people don't understand, you see, people think Tibetan people are just Buddhist and nothing else, but what they don't know, there was a great shamanic culture under the name of Bompo, or Burn, which was 25,000 years earlier than the Buddhist culture. And my grandfather, or my grandmother was that culture. So I, from very early age, was brought up in this particular culture which says that what one has to do, one has to build a rainbow body so one can reach enlightenment in this life or at the time.
And was it not prior to the Buddhists, with the ancient Tibetan culture, that the breathing sequences that is mistaken for meditation, the sequence, the mathematical sequences in breathing, that they developed that, which is really something.
The secret of the trance.
Yes. There is so much there. And whenever I see indigenous people in the Amazon, they so much remind me of the Asian people. And some of them look Tibetan, Cambodian, Vietnamese, some look Japanese, some look Chinese. It's just absolutely amazing. And so I think that all the knowledge brought to Amazon did come from Asia. That's what I think.
We're getting pretty close. And by the way, folks, I want to tell you a little bit about the Order of St. Lazarus, which Dr. Drew and Dr. and James belong to. You can go to stlazarus.co, and the very second picture you're going to see in the slideshow, the second person from the right is James, right after his investiture. The order is one of the, if not the oldest, chivalric order in the world. The grandson of Haile Selassie was just invested. And its origins are allegedly stem from a leper hospice that was founded in Jerusalem in the 4th or 5th century. According to some historians, it was first established during the time of St. Basil, with the founding of its first hospital in the city of Acre. And other authors state that the source of the name of the order stems from the fact that it was started by a group of Armenian monks that worked under the rule of St. Basil. But this is a fascinating website, St. Lazarus, stlazarus.co. I want to encourage everybody to explore that. And other than that, we do need to go because we're going to run out of stream here in a second.
Okay, well I'm going to sign off early. Thank you both, and thank everybody for listening.
Thank you.
Doctor, it's been an absolute honor to speak to you this evening.
Likewise.
And we have so much in common, and I'm just glad to have met you. It makes perfect sense.
You'll have to stop by Austin sometime and meet Dr. Roger.
Absolutely. Come and see us.
Yeah, definitely. We'll arrange that.
You wouldn't believe the home that he built there. It's a seven-sided priest house. And, Dr. Drew, I'll send you a link to a picture of it.
Yeah, please do that. Please do that.
A 30-foot waterfall.
Everybody take good care of themselves and be safe in your travels. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Cheers.
So the path is not easy. I'm grateful for this life, for the chance to behold your face again. When my sacred journey's over, when it all comes to an end, I'll enter the next life.
as Blue Otter, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
OCO.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? Thank you.